This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Amid Bangladesh's recent political turmoil, disturbing videos of brutal attacks on Hindus flooded social media. However, many, including journalists, dismissed them as fake news. Join me, Sahar Zand, to hear how many Hindus in the country are now living in fear.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Animals can't speak to drivers, but if they could, they would be asking us, telling us by the sounds of it, to put our litter and fruit waste in the bin. Because roadside litter kills an estimated 3 million animals every year. No wonder they sound miffed. So let's lend them a paw. Let's take our rubbish with us and bin it properly. National Highways. And what's that? They said thanks very much.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, a Kenyan scientific breakthrough involving the guts of plastic-eating worms. It'll all make sense, I promise, because we'll be hearing from Dr. Fatia Khamis, the scientist who led the team that made the discovery. And as the Nigerian cost of living continues to soar, pet owners say they can't afford to feed their beloved furry companions.
I spent about $150 per month.
And what would you be spending the money on?
There's the litter, sand, food, also toys. It's hard enough for you as a person to, you know, keep up with the prices of things for yourself. Then, you know, now having a pet to do that for.
We'll also explore changing attitudes to living with animals with a man who loves them so much, he lets them sleep on his bed. He also treats them when they're ill. He's a vet. It's Friday, the 3rd of January. First, we go to Egypt. It once had the highest rate of viral hepatitis in the world. From the 1950s to the 1980s, nearly 6 million Egyptians were accidentally infected with the liver-attacking virus hepatitis C. They caught the virus due to unsafe injections given to them during a government program to treat schistosomiasis, more commonly known as bilharzia. The health authorities managed to get bilharzia under control, and then from the early 1990s, they began to tackle hepatitis C. The social and media costs of hepatitis forced them to step it up because by 2015, more than 5 million people were living with the effects of the illness. Now, Egypt has received recognition for the progress it's made in eliminating it through the 100 million Healthier Lives campaign. Let's hear how they did it and what other countries can learn from Egypt. Dr. Imam Waked is a professor of medicine at the National Liver Institute. First off, what is hepatitis C?
Hepatitis C is a disease caused by a virus that enters the body through a blood transfusion or any infected instruments that penetrate the body, like syringes or needles, and it goes to the liver, where it lives most of the time continuously, chronically, causing a slow liver inflammation that progresses over the years until it causes what we call liver cirrhosis and liver damage at the end.
Can you die from it?
You can die from the complications of liver cirrhosis. The hepatitis C virus itself does not kill, but when it causes advanced liver disease and liver failure can cause death and can cause complications that can cause death.
So how do you know you've got hepatitis C and you have liver cirrhosis?
When somebody gets hepatitis C, it usually has no symptoms for many, many years, tens of years, 20, 25, 30 years, until it causes advanced liver disease. During this period, which is very long, the only way to know that the person is infected is by doing a lab test. The lab test can diagnose the presence of hepatitis C, and further lab tests can show if the person has advanced liver disease.
So when we say a cirrhosis, what does that mean? Does it mean scarring on the liver or what?
It means scarring, extensive scarring. Scarring starts in a way what we call fibrosis, which progresses slowly and slowly and slowly over the years until it causes extensive scarring, which is what we call liver cirrhosis.
So tell us about the 100 million Healthier Lives campaign in Egypt.
In 2013, 2014, new drugs were developed for hepatitis C. They are very effective drugs that can be taken orally with almost no side effects or very, very few side effects. And we introduced the drugs in Egypt. Egypt had the highest problem in the world with hepatitis C. We had almost 10% of the population were chronically infected with hepatitis C. In 2014, 2015, we started treating everybody who was infected with hepatitis C. Until 2017, early 18, we had treated everybody who was aware of the diagnosis. Around 2 million had been treated in that time. But as I told you, or as I said, hepatitis C has no symptoms. And we estimated that there were at least 2 to 3 million who were already infected, and they were not aware of the diagnosis. So the government and the Ministry of Health in Egypt decided that the best way to find and cure everybody was to screen the adult population in the country, find everybody who was infected, and treat them in a very, very short time. So we started what we called the 100 million healthy lives, so that everybody in the country would be healthy. We had a national campaign where we screened all the adult population and all the children in middle school and high school above the age of 12. And people would go to screening sites, get a rapid screening test through a finger prick and a drop of blood, very similar to the blood glucose test that you can get using a strip. And all those who are positive were referred to be evaluated and treated. In 7 months, we screened 50 million persons and 12 million middle and high school children. We found and identified 2.4 million who were positive for the hepatitis C antibody using the rapid test. And of these, 1.7 million were chronically infected, were treated with a cure rate above 98.5%.
We're talking about a time before COVID when people were very receptive to being tested and being treated in this way. It almost feels like we wouldn't be able to do that now. But I'm just wondering, how receptive were people actually to being treated and being tested?
People were very receptive. The outcome of the people coming for screening was beyond our expectations. And as you said, we were very lucky in the country that this started and ended before COVID. We completed the screening and the treatment in 2019 before COVID hit by the end of 2019, early 2020.
Would you be able to do the same now, do you think?
I think now that COVID has almost gone and gone from the memory of the people. If a disease has the same bad reputation as hepatitis C had in Egypt, people would come. Hepatitis C in Egypt, because it was a very high prevalent disease and it had a lot of stigmatization. A person with hepatitis C who was not able to find employment because of pre-medical checks and so on. So people were very keen to be tested and treated to prevent infecting other people.
So let's see if Egypt's experience of eradicating or reducing the debt burden to such an extent that it almost has disappeared in Egypt can be shared with other African countries. What would you say were the reasons why Egypt succeeded?
First, Egypt has almost eliminated the disease. The prevalence has gone down from 10% to less than 0.5%. Now it stands at 0.4 or 0.35%. The reason that Egypt was very successful was because of a multitude of factors. One of the important factors is the availability of a very cheap and very effective treatment with very, very few side effects and very easy to take. Number two, there was a very strong political support for the program. The whole government was behind the program. There was continuous government support. The president himself kept supporting the program all through until the end of the screening and treatment period. Number three, the availability of funds. All funds for treatment and screening and treatment were available upfront, and everything was free to the patients. The whole population did not pay anything. It was all borne by the expense of the state.
Was it expensive for the government, I mean?
The program of screening the 50 million people, identifying and curing almost close to 2 million of these, was at a cost of around $200 million, $210 million. To identify and cure an adult person who was unaware of his diagnosis was at a cost of $130. $130 to cure a person, which is a very trivial amount compared to the possibility of acquiring advanced liver disease and caring for a patient with advanced liver disease.
So was this one of those forward-looking health policies where you spend the money now in order to save huge amounts of money in the future?
Yes, we calculate and estimate that every dollar spent in this campaign saves close to $30 to $40 in the following 10 years.
So if you were to speak to other African health ministers and health professionals, what would you say they need to look out for if they try to emulate the success that Egypt has had?
I would tell them that Egypt is a very important model for eliminating hepatitis C. Almost all countries in Africa share the same limited resources. We're a very limited resource country. Treatment now is very cheap, very effective. If you find the patients and treat them, you can cure them very quickly, and you can get rid of the disease. There are other shining examples in Africa. Rwanda is another country that has an excellent program, and they're very close to eliminating hepatitis C in Rwanda. And other countries are now screening the population. I know Ghana is screening its population. They identified the high infection rate and high infection areas. And Egypt as a country is willing to help any African country that has a hepatitis C problem in providing know-how, advice, and free medication.
Are there countries that have taken up that offer besides Rwanda and Ghana?
Rwanda started before we made that offer. The Rwandan program is very successful and ongoing with their own help and with the help of international organizations. In Ghana, we are providing medication. In Chad, we have provided medication and medical advice and consultation. In South Sudan, we're also doing that. And we're open to any other country that is intending to go on the path to eliminate hepatitis C.
That's Dr. Imam Waked, Professor of Medicine at the National Liver Institute in Egypt. Could the solution to Africa's escalating plastic pollution problem lie in the gut of a very tiny insect? Might do, if the research being done by Kenyan scientists at the International Center of Insect Physiology and Ecology pays off. They've made a groundbreaking discovery. The larva of the dark lesser mealworm can digest styrofoam, mainstay takeaway container for many a wedding or funeral goer, but one of the most difficult plastics to recycle. Scientists have long known that there are plastic-consuming worms, but this discovery moves things quite far along, and it has the potential to revolutionize how we tackle plastic waste. But don't take my word for it. Let's hear from the scientist behind the breakthrough, Dr. Fatia Khamis in Kenya.
In the past decade, we've been working on insect for food and feed program. And in our quest to get more insects into this program, we came across the mealworm in our chicken coop. We had kept chicken for research, and then we found these mealworms. And we took them to the lab to rear them. And of course, these mealworms look like mealworms that have been researched on in other parts of the world, especially in Europe and US. There's the tenebrio, while this in Africa is, again, a darker mealworm, but of different species. So when we got this insect and kept it, we wanted to do fast identification. And when we saw the similarity to what has been researched on, so I thought of, okay, let me put them on styrofoam to see if it can feed on it. When it feeds on it, then we can do its gut content. So we see what the gut has, if it has bacteria that are similar to what has been discovered before. So we did some work for identification using DNA and molecular biology, but also now we kept it overnight to feed on plastic. And when we came in the morning, we saw that it was boring through the styrofoam. So this was like a breakthrough. We were so happy. Now we set up proper experimentation to see if it can feed on the plastic and also survive its full cycle. So we kept it on, some of it on the styrofoam only, and some of it on the normal feed that we give it, like wheat bran, and also a source of fluid, like rotten fruits or organic waste. And it was feeding, the one on plastic also survived equally well. So this is how we came across the study.
So why were you particularly excited that it had borne through the styrofoam, that it was able to digest styrofoam?
Yeah, it could tell us that it is actually similar to the species elsewhere, the Tenebrio species, that was feeding, or it was discovered to feed on plastic, and it had bacteria in the gut that could degrade plastic.
But I'm wondering, why styrofoam? Is it because styrofoam is particularly difficult?
Yes, and also it is common in the labs because we have equipment or the glassware that comes with it, and we use a lot of this styrofoam for packaging of samples when we take it or when we receive glassware and all that. So we thought of that to be our first. We just gave it to try. And actually we went also a step further to give it cellophane for it to feed, and we could see that it was feeding on cellophane also.
I thought that you were excited about styrofoam because styrofoam is a very hard plastic to degrade, and the environmental impact of it is particularly damaging.
Oh, yes. And it is okay. It is also voluminous. When we put it on it and we saw it boring through and feeding through, and even to the extent we could trace that it was even going to further life cycle producing within the styrofoam. We could even take out pupae within the styrofoam. So it was comfortable within the styrofoam feeding and also going through other cycle of life.
So what is the practical application of this discovery?
The practical application actually is not the mealworm, but what we can harness from it in terms of its gut bacteria in the larvae of this of the mealworm. Or we go further to identify the enzymes and see if this enzyme or the bacteria can be harnessed or can be exploited for plastic degradation. Because it's not really realistic to put all the mealworms to this work. It's also a pest. It's a storage pest. And also in these chicken coops, it also destroys the insulators in the chicken coops.
So if I'm to understand what you're saying, it's not so much that we'll use the mealworm to break down plastic. It's that we'll cultivate the enzymes that you find within the gut of the mealworm to do that. So we do it without the mealworm.
Yes, because mealworm also, elsewhere in the world, they have been certified as safe for food, for feed, for organic fertilizer, and also for degrading waste. So if we can also put these mealworms for all these other functions, and now an additional function of maybe exploiting the gut bacteria or the enzyme to do plastic degradation, this would be nice. Yes, there's a trade-off. You either put them for plastic, but also we have to go further to see if there's a bioaccumulation of this plastic in their body, or if they will be producing something harmful, which can be dangerous now to the environment. You don't want to put something bad back to the environment.
Yeah, because we have had cases, haven't we? Many cases where you introduce a species to get rid of one problem, and then the introduction of that species creates a whole lot of problems. It reminds me of a song that we used to sing as children. I won't sing because I don't want to damage people's eardrums, but it goes along the lines of, there was an old woman who swallowed a fly. She swallowed a fly to catch the spider. She swallowed a spider to catch the fly. And then she swallowed something else to catch the spider, she had swallowed to catch the fly. And the question is, we don't know why she swallowed the fly.
Yeah.
In this case,
also, and also, when you see our experiment, it's not that you can put one mealworm that can feed on a lot of plastic. We are putting around 100 to 150 mealworms to feed on 3.6 grams of this. So it's actually, it's not so nice to look at. You want to harness what it can give.
So in order to make this a reality, in order to exploit to the full and for the benefit of so many countries that even though they've banned the use of single-use plastic, countrysides are still littered with plastic, livestock still dying from eating plastic, our seas are being choked with plastic. What do you need to scale it up?
What we need is further research to get to this bacteria, because this will be the ideal solution, not the actual mealworm. So we harness what it has in the gut while we also utilize the mealworm for other function, like for feed, for food, to also degrade the organic waste, produce fertilizer for us, the organic fertilizer, very nice fertilizer from it. And also now get the benefit of getting this bacteria or the enzymes that can do the plastic degradation, and which this could be the scalable products.
How long have you been working on this?
Okay, we did start this work for quite some time because, of course, there's the discovery phase. There's also now the confirmation phase and then the write-up and the publication. So it was quite like 2 to 3 years of work.
It doesn't sound a lot to be looking at, tiny insects and seeing what they're doing, seeing what they poo, seeing what they eat.
Yeah, that's why we need some more time now to get to see what actually in this poo, what it has and also what it eats, because it is beneficial for them, because we could see them that they go through this their cycle of life. But now we don't know what is the bioaccumulation of this. Is it harmful inside their bodies and what? So all this needs to be verified. It needs to be researched on. And all this needs verification before actually, yes, putting it into practice. But also now getting this bacteria is another phase of the project.
How much time between now and it becoming a scalable product that can help us get rid of plastic waste?
I will need a partnership. We'll need funding. And then we can take it further.
And that's Dr. Fatia Khamis from the International Center of Insect Physiology and Ecology in Kenya. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Come in, get one ready.
Exciting.
Remembering how to prepare for a road trip is as easy as spelling it. T is for top up, like fuel, oil, and screen wash. R is for rest, taking a break every 2 hours. I is for inspect, like your tire pressure and tread. P is for prepare, being prepared for any weather. TRIP. Remember that, and you're ready for a safe trip.
Are we ready?
Yes, Mum.
National Highways.
Now to Nigeria, where people have to make very difficult choices as the cost of living spirals beyond the reach of their salaries. Cutting costs is the order of the day, and so is cutting ties with beloved members of their family, furry members, animal companions, better known as pets. Difficult as it is, people feel they have to prioritize their own survival over that of their pets. Odenike Oresenya is a cat lover in Lagos.
I currently have 2 cats. I had to give away some and sell some.
How many did you have?
I had about 7. Yeah, 7 in total.
Why did you give them away?
The cost of maintaining all of them, and I also did not plan to have that much, so it just happened. I spent about $150 per month.
And what would you be spending the money on?
There's the litter, sand, food, also toys, and yeah, vet visits.
So did it become too costly for you?
Yes, especially with the way our economy just became terrible in the past 1 year. Things have doubled in price, almost tripled in price in the last 1 year. So it's even hard enough for you as a person to, you know, keep up with the prices of things for yourself. Then, you know, now having a pet to do that for. Many people don't even subscribe to having pets at this because of that. And I think we've started devising like other means to feed them, because cat food is more expensive over here because they import them. So people are now looking at alternatives, like, you know, giving them normal human food, eggs, chicken, and all of that.
Odenike Oresenya in Lagos. Now, there are so many myths and prejudices around Africans and animals. We thought we'd take a closer look at that relationship with Dr. Mark Ofua, a vet in Lagos. He told me he loves animals more than he loves people, and I nearly agreed with him. But we began our discussion with Dr. Ofua, where we left off with Odenike, the painful choices people are being forced to make as prices soar and survival is at stake. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak to us when most of the world is on holiday. Here you are. Are you working today?
Oh, well, yes. So as a veterinarian, we never have holidays in that sense. We are always attending to one animal or the other. And if it has to do with animal welfare or talking about animals, you can call me up 24/7.
Why is that? Do you love animals or is it a lucrative business?
So I have this shirt that says I love dogs more than people, and it sets me lots of enemies, but I think I love animals. I am more comfortable around them, yeah.
Well, I'm kind of with you. There are lots of dogs I prefer to some people that I know.
Exactly. Exactly.
And were you always like this as a child? Did you always love animals?
Oh, yes. I was a troublesome kid that you never could know what he will do next. I remember bringing in eggs that I find in the bush and bring them to the house to hatch. And then we'll get a surprise lizard or a surprise snake or something. I always was fascinated by animals, and my siblings knew to be very careful around me.
A lot of people have the idea that animals as pets is not really a concept that you find readily across African countries.
Well, we have been raised culturally to have this healthy fear of animals. And this fear has been mixed with myths and untruths, you know, that makes us see these animals even more as a problem. Cats are witches, dogs, once they bite you, it's rabies, you're gone, you know. So these myths actually make us keep away from animals. In my growing up, in my world of discovery, I come to find out that these things are not true.
Well, what you're saying, I can so relate to, because my family and people around us, we've always had pets. We've always had dogs, cats, birds, etc. But I suppose it's the levels of which people treat. So dogs, for us, mostly stayed outside. Cats do what they want.
Yeah, exactly.
So there are different ways in which people and cultures treat animals that they regard animals as their companions, right? So in Nigeria, what would you say people's attitudes generally are? Who are the people who bring their pets in for you to treat?
The attitude to pets in Nigeria generally, well, same as the African context. Dogs are outside. That breaks my heart all the time. People come to my house and see dogs inside and they wonder if I'm well or something. A dog sleeps on my bed and they think,
oh,
I'm
no,
weird.
No. I love dogs, but dog on the bed, not so much. Not even on the couch. Maybe on a rug.
I have a couple of huskies, huge dogs, and they come on the bed, you know. They are part of my family. They answer my name. But in Nigeria, especially in cosmopolitan Lagos, the urban area, the attitude is changing gradually. You're having people who are coming to see dogs and cats, not just as companion animals or pets, but as members of the family. The other day, I had a client walk into my office to register his pet, and he says, oh, the dog's name is Sky. And he gave his surname to the dog as well, Sky Umbadu, as the dog's name. People are becoming more and more invested in their animals as part of the family.
Why is that?
Well, I would think it has to do with urbanization. You know, in the rural areas, it's more about family. It's more about communal living. So you hardly get people who are living alone or who are bored or who are lonely. But in the urban life, with the elitist settings of Lagos State, you have people who stay alone more now, you know, single people who live alone, unmarried people and all that. And then that part of them that needs to communicate reaches out to get a pet. And then they come to discover this very unique bond that you can have with your pets. Yeah.
Now, Nigeria is facing a cost of living crisis. And the reason why we are talking to you is that we're seeing a rise in the number of people who have to heartbreakingly abandon their pets because they can't care for them anymore.
Oh, yes. There's this joke we make in Nigeria that the cost of living is about to kill the living. It's rising astronomically in the last couple of years. And still, up to about 80% of pet ownership in Nigeria, more than that, say 80-85% of pet ownership in Nigeria, is not for the emotional bond. It's just for what a pet can do for them. For example, dogs, security dog, or for production, to sell, to raise money, and all that. So it's not really for the emotional ties. And because of this, with the increasing costs of living, the increasing cost of feeding or owning a dog, the trend I've come to see is that the animal is the first to suffer. So in a household where there is a pet or pets, and then things have become more expensive, the first point where the axe hits is the pet care. So you have people giving up their animals that, oh, they can't cater for them again. I had a client that had about 4 dogs, and he told me he wanted to give them up. And I said, well, I said, oh, the vet bill is high. I'm like, okay, you've been my client for a while. Let's do this. I'll treat 2 of them for free, and then you pay for 2 of them. And he smiles and I say, oh, that's very generous of you, but would you feed them as well?
So what are people then doing with their dogs and cats and the animals that they can't afford to keep anymore?
Over the years, people had 1 or 2 reasons to give up their animals. Traditionally, they fall into 2 groups. A large percentage want to kill the animal or give the animal to people that eat them, you know. A small percentage of people that, you know, have bonded with this animal but can no longer, for one reason or the other, keep them, will bring to me and say, oh, help me put the dog down. I can't afford to keep it again. But when I put a dog down for no reason, the dog isn't sick, dignity is not affected, it's just because the owner cannot take care of it. When I put a dog down for that, I usually get this emotional backlash where for a couple of days I'm moody and I'm very, very depressed and all that. I snap at my staff and all that. So something happened and I decided, oh, why don't you start a shelter? I had never seen a shelter or how it operated before. But I started one and I put word out there that, hey, instead of killing your dog or giving it up to be eaten, you can bring it up to the shelter and then we'll look for good homes for them. When people realize that they can't take care of their animals anymore, they can't afford to own the pet or take care of the bills that's associated with the pet, they give them up to be adopted by other families.
But that's a very limited number of animals that you can look after and feed and other people able to look after them. We're hearing that a lot of people are just abandoning the animals, taking them somewhere and leaving them there. What are the difficulties associated with that approach?
So, yes, you're right. There's a limit to the number we can take in. In fact, like 3 years ago, I was at my capacity. The rate at which they come does not match the rate at which they find homes, you see. So we are at capacity. If you come to the shelter now, there are dogs and cats literally everywhere, you know.
How many do you have? How many do you have?
Oh, currently, I have about 160 animals that include dogs, cats, and then a few exotic animals. Yeah. So some people who don't have access to the shelter, don't know about it. Yes, they still do the abandoning of the dog, drive up to the highway and let go of the dog. You know, it's very, very, very distressing. Some of them don't even know how to cross the highway and they become roadkill. Very sadly, some of them are lucky enough to find people who will take them in because they're beautiful and cute, but some of them become strays and become a problem to the environment.
What sort of problem do stray dogs present to the environment and to people?
First of all, the nuisance value, the eat by scavenging, by stealing, and what have you. Some of them are already used to humans, so they would always want to trail with humans or sneak into homes. And there is the ever-present problem of rabies. You know, they get infected from rodents and wildlife around, and because of their proximity to humans, they can transmit this. So it's economically not viable, it's health-wise not viable, and it's an act that we should stop as much as is possible.
How can you stop it? Because the facts are stark. People can't afford to feed themselves and even less animals.
Well, education really is the key, education and enlightenment. First of all, if you're getting a pet, and that's where it starts from, realize that it's a lifelong commitment. You cannot get a pet and get tired of it. Just the way things don't get hard and then you give up your child. There are times when, me personally, I wouldn't have food to eat. I'm broke. I'm going through a difficult time. But my animals have their food in the fridge. But now, say you've gotten a pet and things are tight, you think you can no longer afford to keep that pet. Find somebody who would be willing to take over the ownership of the pet.
The thing is, though, life is difficult for people. You can't abandon your children because there are consequences to that. But some children do get abandoned. But pets, people still don't regard them on the same level as human beings. But aren't we looking at life here, you know, that people have really difficult choices to make?
These animals didn't choose you. You chose them. You made the choice. So you live with it. You live with the consequences. What will make me give up my dog will be something that I know that I am at very last breath. There's nothing else. I have no other choice. And in doing that, I would look for a responsible home where this animal will find love.
So how do you think governments, nonprofit organizations, community organizations, and so on can actually help to conscientize people, to make them aware that these are profound acts of cruelty, and but also step in with practical help?
First of all, there are laws, but nobody really cares about these laws. There are places like the shelter. I know it's difficult for the government to give money to shelters, but they could do things like tax rebates, you know. Oh, if you're running a shelter, we give you this leverage and all that to make it easier for more people to join the practice.
I'm heartened by talking to you because this story really depressed me when I looked at it. Because I know that people love their animals. They really do. And they don't want to abandon them. So thank you so much. That's Dr. Mark Ofua, a vet in Lagos. Focus on Africa was put together by Nyasha Michelle, Stefania Okereke, Amy Leibovitz, and Bella Hassan here in London. Blessing Aderogba was in Lagos. Patricia Whitehorn was the senior journalist. The technical producer was Philip Bull. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Thank you for listening.
What do Tiger Woods, Mark Zuckerberg, and Taylor Swift all have in common? Well, their lives and fortunes are all being discussed on Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, motives, and the money of some of the world's wealthiest individuals. I'm Xing Xing, and each week my co-presenter Simon Jack and I take a closer look at the world's mega rich, and we try to decide whether they're good, bad, or just another billionaire. From celebs and CEOs to sports stars and tech titans, find out how billionaires made their money and how they use it. Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. All episodes of Season 1 and 2 are available now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And click follow or subscribe so you never miss a new episode.